Hi, I'm Sam Cedar.
And I'm Emma Vigeland. This week on Ring of Fire, Branko Markatich, a Jacobin staff writer and author of Yesterday's Man, The Case Against Joe Biden, joins me to talk about the false choice between fighting the pandemic and saving the economy.
And Heather Digby Parton will help me wrap up this year's show as we discuss the Trump presidency and the characters that enabled him for the past 4 years. If you're listening to the free podcast right now, do us both a favor. Support this program. You can help us out by becoming a member at ROFpodcast.com. Here to break down this week's news and a look back on last year and a look forward to next year, Heather Digby Parton from Salon and her popular blog, Hullabaloo. So, Heather, this is the final time that we will speak for Ring of Fire in 2020. I want that to sound too dramatic because we're only about a week away from the end of the year. But in terms of the news this week, obviously we've got some more positions filled by Joe Biden. In his cabinet, we have also a stimulus bill that has passed earlier this week. And we have Donald Trump deeper in his bunker where the ship is, taking on enough water that a bunch of the rats have started to jump off. There's some that are still hanging on to the masts, I guess, just to elongate this metaphor. So let's talk about the things that have happened, this week. And then, we'll take a moment to sort of look back on this year, which has been really just atrocious. And then look forward to next year as if we have any type of clarity of what could possibly happen. Although I have some ideas. But let's start with the stimulus. There is not a lot of bad stuff in the stimulus. There is not enough of the good stuff in the stimulus, but it is what it is. I think David Dayen made a very good point the other day. I was talking to him about this. He's like, if David Perdue gets an extra 0.3% in Georgia, we may not have any stimulus whatsoever.
Gosh. Wow. I mean, I hadn't even thought about that, but that's kind of crazy.
And let me just be clear on what I mean by that is that, Mitch McConnell has been explicit that he needed the stimulus because Loeffler and Perdue are getting hammered by the fact that there has been no help, that you've got 12 million people who are about to get kicked off unemployment. You've got another 12, maybe more, 17 million who are facing eviction. There's eviction moratoriums happening that were pushed at least a month. There's $25 billion worth of rental assistance in the bill that will help people pay some of that back rent. And then maybe we'll see Joe Biden extend it. We've got unemployment extension. We've got extended unemployment that expands unemployment, including people who don't traditionally qualify for unemployment in terms of time. That goes out about 9 weeks, I think it is. We have an extra $300 per person who are unemployed on top of what they're getting from the state. That's coming from the feds. We have $600 per person in the country. You get a $600 check if your income is less than $75,000 combined. 90,000 is the top end, but it diminishes between that. I'm not exactly sure how, and it's for dependents as well, except for not adult dependents. So people who might have have disabilities or other things that are the adult dependents would not be eligible for that $600. I mean, all good, but not good enough, because this is not going to last. Joe Biden's going for a second bite at the apple, supposedly. I don't know what kind of leverage he'll have. It so much turns on Georgia in that respect. But what's your sense of this bill and I guess the idea that maybe there was an opportunity to get more earlier? I don't know.
Well, I don't know. And you and I have talked about this quite a bit over the last few months. I mean, we know that the Democrats came out in May with the HEROES Act, which was what was it worth, something like $3 trillion. It was a massive relief package, and of course both the White House and the Republicans stonewalled that throughout the summer, even though it was obvious and everyone knew we were going to be facing this awful winter. They just ignored it. And then there was that period where the White House was negotiating directly with Nancy Pelosi in the House, and that's sort of the one where we don't know. I mean, supposedly there was an offer of $1.8 trillion, and Nancy Pelosi didn't take it, and, you know, I don't know yet that we really fully understand it, although it sure looks in retrospect like that would have been a good deal to take if it was real. And Mitch McConnell throughout has been, you know, completely reluctant to do this. I mean, he's got, I think they say, 30 people in his caucus who were against doing this all the way along for anything, no money whatsoever, because they're pretending like they care about deficits and they really, you know, basically just don't want to do anything because they hate spending money on actual human beings instead of tanks and guns or tax cuts for their rich benefactors. But, you know, what we're looking at now, it's not bad, and it's better than I thought it was going to be. I mean, I sort of assumed that they were going to be able to – I mean, they threw in at the last minute – we saw Senator Toomey from Pennsylvania. He was – wasn't he a, you know, a Club for Growth guy? I mean,
yep.
Wasn't that his original thing? So,
yep.
You know, he's – that says everything about him, right? I mean, we know where he comes from. And he threw in that poison pill at the end about, you know, kind of taking away the Fed's ability to do – anything, not just under the CARES Act provisions that were put through last spring for the pandemic, but anything going forward. I mean, it was really trying to slam the door on the Fed's ability to step in these, you know, financial emergencies. Luckily, the Democrats beat that back, at least the worst of it. You know, they did manage to take away whatever that remaining funding was that they had left over from the CARES Act, but they didn't preclude them from doing anything in the future. So, you know, I guess they did the best they could. But honestly, you know, you look at this, I mean, the mere fact that they waited until the very end is appalling. It's just absolutely appalling. I mean, we're up against, you know, massive evictions, people, you know, at Christmas time. I mean, we're up against people losing all of their unemployment, you know, much less the extra money that was provided in the CARES Act. You know, this was a horrifying thing that it took this long, that the Republicans stonewalled it this long. And it's exactly, I think, what you said. I mean, Mitch McConnell, for all of his deviousness and cunning, often comes out and says exactly what he's going to do,
yeah,
and why he's doing it. And in this case, he, in a phone call that was recorded and was, you know, made public, said, you know, we've got to help out Kelly and Dave. You know, Kelly and Dave are dying down there, and we need to get past this thing. So it was purely political. It had nothing to do with doing the right thing. It had nothing to do with even helping his own constituents. I mean, Kentucky needs money too, not just anything else.
There have been Republican mayors who have been begging him for support, and ultimately no municipal or state funding whatsoever, none. And so he's, you know, he does not care. I mean,
no.
This guy is sociopathic in that regard. I mean, it's just, there's no other way to describe it. He was bragging about keeping the mandate for sick pay for people with COVID off of the bill. I mean, so people should understand. There was, under the CARES Act, a mandate that if you had COVID, your employer had to pay you to not come into work because you have COVID and we're in the middle of a pandemic. And he's bragging that he got rid of that provision. That's insanity. And
total insanity.
This is what I find frustrating, right? Like, I know that Mitch McConnell is a sociopath. I mean, let me rephrase that. I don't know that he's a sociopath. I know that his behavior is of that of a sociopath. Maybe he's not. I don't. I'm not a clinician. And What frustrates me is that it's been clear that Mitch McConnell is this way for years. He is like an immovable existing object. And, you know, you mentioned the HEROES Act. Nancy Pelosi said from the beginning, this is a messaging bill, right? And it was just, the messaging was poor. Because the only thing that you and I know about the HEROES Act, I mean, I know some of the details and this and that, but it's a messaging bill. Presumably it should go beyond people who, you know, professionally read into this stuff. There's two things that people heard from the HEROES Act. And that's, you know, even then, if you knew those two things, you're in a very, very small percentile. And that is, it's called the HEROES Act and that it was $3 trillion.
Right.
And there was some really bad stuff in there, too, like subsidizing COBRA instead of expanding, let's say, Medicare temporarily or something like that. But putting that aside, it was a poor messaging bill. And it's been frustrating. I was listening to the radio Tuesday morning when the bill was being talked about, listening to the radio, listening to a music station. And they do like the bottom of the hour and the top of the hour, AP news, you know, AP news minute. Da, 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 da. And the only thing they say is after months of fighting, Congress has agreed to a package. End of story. And really, the story has been, after months of not agreeing to anything, the Republicans come to the table and bring something. But the problem is that it's the way these negotiations happen is stonewalled in that way. I mean, you know, like McConnell had $500 million bill that he kept bringing up, but it was filibustered. He was happy to have it not go anywhere, but he had the ability to create this narrative. The Democrats just have not taken advantage of moments when they get them, like that $1.8 trillion. Maybe there was nothing in that bill, but you know what? If there's nothing in the bill, you call their bluff and you say, bring it to a vote. And if Mitch McConnell says he's not going to vote it, then you need to, like, they don't win the political fights when they lose. And this is when they lose the material fight, where they lose the fight on substance. They don't even win the political fight. They never make the Republicans pay a political price, which, you know, theoretically accrues over time, and then you get to use that political cachet you've built. And this is something that you and I have been talking about for 15 years. There's just it's just the most frustrating thing in the world. And at one point, I understand why some people get very cynical and say maybe they just don't want to even win. But it's also, you'd expect them at the very least to, you'd want them to. You'd think that they would collect these political chits because it would give them more power, but no.
Well, it's called losing well, and it is I don't mean that in the sense that you're gracious. It's that you know how to take advantage of whatever, you know, the loss sort of provides you, and you use that going forward to you know, press your case the next time. I mean, Republicans are really good at that, right? I mean, they've done that. Think of the Affordable Care Act. I mean, they lost big time on that, but they managed to sabotage it over and over and over again for years, and they ended up, you know, using that sabotage to convince governors, for instance, in red states to refuse massive amounts of money for their states from the federal government by refusing that Medicaid expansion. I mean, they used that. I mean, they lost, but they also won because and their messaging on it was that this is terrible. It's a government takeover of your health care, blah, blah, blah. And boy, did they ever use it politically, right? Because you remember 2010. I mean, it was the ugliest election for Democrats that I can remember. I mean, worse than 1994, I think. Well, maybe not that bad, but it was really bad. And they are able to do that. And by the way, 1994 was the same thing. They messaged their loss in 92, the Congress did, and used that to do a tremendous takeover. Now, you know, Democrats managed to do some things, you know, in 2018. They had a nice big, you know, blue wave, and they took over the House, but they missed the Senate. And, you know, that was a miss. I mean, it really was. Really big miss this time, you know, because they had a lot more chances to win this time, and they didn't really take good advantage of that. And, I mean, if you can't do it with Donald Trump,
Right.
You know, if you can't turn Donald Trump into a liability for the Republican party, what do you need? I mean, you know, so, I mean, I agree with you completely. You know, the inability to sort of take a loss like Donald Trump or, you know, whatever, I mean, say, and turn it into something that you can use against them and build that up is a real liability for Democrats. And I'm not sure, I've never been sure why they can't do it. It doesn't seem that complicated to me. You know, but you have to be kind of ruthless about it. You really do. You've got to be willing to go. I'm kind of hopeful that the new guard in the Congress sees that. I mean, when I see stuff like coming out about what AOC said about this negotiation, for instance, really taking it to McConnell. And she wasn't nice to the Democrats either. You know, she held them up as being responsible, too. But she really, her messaging throughout, at least from what I'm seeing on Twitter, and, you know, granted, maybe that's not a full, you know, sort of example of what she's talking about. But I see a much stronger sort of message coming out from some of the newer members of Congress, like Katie Porter and others, that I'm hopeful will start to take hold, that they're seeing the stakes here and are, you know, I'm honestly, I think a lot of it is, well, we don't, you know, we want to maintain comedy so that we can have, you know, bipartisan agreements down the road and all of that. And I think the younger people are kind of going, you know what, that really hasn't worked out. So let's try something different.
Well, the most encouraging thing in my mind in terms of on that sort of thing that you're talking about is we're seeing reform within the Progressive Caucus, where Pramila Jayapal is now the sole chairperson.
Yep.
Which means that they can move with a certain amount of nimbleness that they couldn't before. There's a little bit more direction. Katie Porter, I think, is now number two in the Progressive Caucus, and Ilhan Omar is now the whip. And they are also talking about reforms that sound like they are going to start to expect more of their caucus members beyond just giving $4,000 dues. In other words, you need to hold certain positions. You need to, you know, vote with us in a certain amount of time, you know, in a certain number of times. Like, this is no longer just a, you know, a brand. This is no longer just like a mail away, you know, a college degree type of situation. You're going to actually have to attend classes and, you know, that type of thing. And that is encouraging in terms of building this power. And hopefully we will see more of that. I mean, this is, you know, a good time to sort of just like look back over this year, or I guess we've been doing that. I mean, that's been basically the story, right? Has been the Democrats. And we should say, look, there's not only been a failure of Democrats to make this turn. There has been a logjam of leadership. We've said this almost every week, I feel like. But Nancy Pelosi ruled the House with an iron fist over the past 2 years. She made every subpoena go through her office as opposed to allowing committee chairs to issue their own subpoenas. She was basically, there was no roll call vote on the CARES Act. They didn't even bring people in or figure out a way to actually do any real voting until deep into the summer, if I remember correctly, even though they were able to do, you know, they were voting in the Senate. You certainly could have come up with a technological fix, but to a large extent, it was just Nancy Pelosi's show, period, end of story. There was just no opportunity for any of the members of the House or the Democratic caucus to do anything. You know, this year is obviously hopeful insofar as that Donald Trump is no longer the president. I'm happy about that. Very, very happy, both for the most marginalized in this country who have suffered immensely under Donald Trump. And I'm thinking like immigrant families and refugees and what we've seen in terms of the environment and what we've seen in terms of like the regulatory agencies, just atrocious. What we saw police departments basically told, you know, the gloves are off, go to it. I mean, I don't think that was a coincidence, frankly. And the rise in hate But also, you know, even from a personal level, I'm so glad not to have to, you know, coexist in my daily work with Donald Trump. I can't even express it to you. But obviously, you know, Joe Biden was not my first pick. And so much depends on Georgia in terms of like what is going to define next year, right? I mean, even if it's only just like one reconciliation bill at the beginning of the year.
I know. And, you know, I don't even, it is very hard for me to see how this goes if the Democrats don't win Georgia. And I don't, I am not placing, you know, I'm just, this is just my personal view. I hope, I'm hoping and hoping that it works. Maybe it will. I think there's a good chance that they will win, but there's also a good chance that they won't. It's really a toss-up. I've been following the you know, I mean, obviously polling's been off all year, and maybe it's off there again, but it really looks like a real jump ball in both of those seats. And it's, you know, it's not, this isn't an easy election. So far, the news looks good that there's a lot of turnout, and maybe, you know, there's a great grassroots organizing in Georgia that may be able to pull this off. I mean, we'll have to see. And, you know, Donald Trump is kind of doing everything he can to sabotage it if he can. I don't know if he knows he's doing that, but all this craziness with the, you know, with the post-election challenging of the election results in Georgia, I don't think is helping. But we don't know what's going to happen there. So, I mean, for me, I mean, if they manage to get a majority or at least get to 50 and then Kamala Harris will be the deciding vote as the presiding as the vice president, you know, we have much better chance of, well, we can set, the Democrats can set the agenda. That makes a huge, huge, huge amount of difference. It is very, very important to have Mitch McConnell out of the leadership and unable to, you know, set the agenda for the Senate. Obviously, the you know, the judges, the confirmations, everything else, that will be a different, will go much more smoothly, and it will be, we'll have different judges being confirmed, I think, under even a small, narrow majority in the Senate. But I got to tell you, Sam, even if we win, our problems won't go away. I mean, I've been writing about this, and I think it's important because I think that people do not understand. Just the institution of the Senate itself is a roadblock to progressive change. It's not impossible. They passed the Affordable Care Act. They've passed progressive legislation. They've managed to get some things through in a crisis that were positive. And on a day-to-day basis, as I said, the Senate is much, much better off under the Democrats than it is under Mitch McConnell. But the Senate is run essentially by a small group of senators in the middle on both the Republican and Democratic side. And you have Mitt Romney and Susan Collins and
Joe
Manchin. And on that side, you've got Joe Manchin, probably Kyrsten Sinema, probably Mark Kelly, probably a few more that are going to find their way into the. I can already see Mark Warner. I saw him on TV this week going on and on about how, well, the leaders in both parties couldn't get it done, and we worked with the problem solvers in the House, and we got the, you know, so you can already see this dynamic coming. And I'm just warning people, if you haven't been in a situation in a while, or you weren't paying close attention, or maybe you were too young to know what was going on, this is what happens, even when the Democrats are in power, is that, you know, and it's a different dynamic than it is when the Republicans are in power, because, you know, although, look at Mitch McConnell, was unable to, repeal the Affordable Care Act because John McCain was angry and he was dying, and so he thumbs down, you know, that night, and the Affordable Care Act survives. So even Mitch McConnell can't always, you know, get his caucus in line, depending on the situation. It's very, very difficult to get anything done in the Senate. I would just remind people that when the Affordable Care Act came up, when it was first being negotiated, the Democrats had 60 votes.
Yeah.
And then Ted Kennedy died. There was the Scott Brown election. They still had 59 votes, and they had to put it through reconciliation. Why? Because they had a bunch of senators in the middle who were arguing, and, you know, they couldn't vote for it. Blanche Lincoln of Arkansas, you know, Ben Nelson of Nebraska. These people, and Joe Lieberman, who would just throw a sand in the gears because he wanted to, because he wanted to punish the Democrats. This is a dynamic that people have to understand. You know, so if you're looking at things like Medicare for All, and you're looking at things like, you know, changing, you know, adding states, you know, to the union, or putting, you know, changing the number on the Supreme Court. I mean, a lot of things that are theoretically possible and should be able to be done when you have a majority. And even if you get rid of the filibuster, which, of course, you know, we all want them to do, and I assume will be done. I mean, it has to be done, really, if they want to even accomplish anything at all. This is not going to be easy because the Senate itself is an undemocratic institution that leans toward doing nothing. If they can do nothing, they are absolutely going to do it. And if they can do something malevolent and the Republicans can get it done, they will do that. And just to get anything progressive done is pulling teeth and has been as long as I can remember. It just is the way that it works. So I don't mean to sound like a pessimist, but people need to be warned that this is the dynamic we're dealing with.
I agree with you. And I think that really, honestly, like, we're going to be looking at one piece of legislation. If this is the best case scenario, right? That they win in Georgia, you're going to get one big reconciliation bill at the beginning, and then there's just going to be, you know, more or less stalemate on just about everything else. Maybe you get an infrastructure bill that is really, you know, comes with, I don't know, some big tax cuts or something, or, you know,
some selling off. For industry, God only knows.
Exactly. Selling off some public assets to some private corporation. And then, you know, you'll get judges, which is important. And and it will be easier for the Biden administration just to competently address stuff because they'll have their nominees approved. That would be good. Again, this is the best case scenario. The in that situation, there are really two cohorts of people who I wonder about. And then one is, like, we have a younger generation who are far less patient and, frankly, far less in better shape than, you know, Gen X was, or the boomers. You know, the millennials are just, they don't have as big of a slice of the pie. And not only do they not have as big of a slice of a pie at the age that my generation did, your generation did, it's that they also, they don't have the same measure of prospects, and they have a whole host of problems and that are not being addressed. There's going to be a lot of impatience there, I think. Then there's also a cohort that, you know, we saw traditionally, and hopefully they don't, but they just go to sleep. Or they just perceive, like, okay, we don't have Donald Trump, it's not important anymore, I'll go to brunch. And those are two, like, big cohorts that I, you know, it's problematic if those people drop out, right, and don't pay attention, and Democrats get wiped out in the midterms, like, and they're unable to do anything for 4 years. I worry about 2024. And so, you know, that is going to be a big problem. The flip side of that is they lose in Georgia, and in some ways you get stalemate, you know, from the beginning, and then you see that again. I mean, I am a little bit nervous, frankly, about going forward. The failure of the Democrats to take advantage of this moment electorally. And I don't know that I can point to a specific thing, but I suspect the reason why Democrats did so poorly is not so much from their campaigns and who they ran and this and that. That definitely has something to do with it. But I think it's just simply when Democrats have some type of power, they didn't have power to pass legislation, but they certainly had, they didn't have, power to enact legislation. But they had power to pass it, and they had power to force the Republicans to vote against certain things. They don't take advantage of it, and they don't contemplate their like, they don't legislate like they're running for re-election.
Well, and let me just point out another advantage that they had, and one that I have never seen in my lifetime, which is they had the media absolutely so hostile to the president and to the Republican Party through a good part of this. I mean, it took the media a while before they actually, you know, started saying the word, you know, that Trump lied and doing all that. But eventually they did. What a huge advantage that is, right? I mean, to be able to have the media, instead of both sidesing everything and saying, well, the Democrats are just as responsible, there's a little bit of that. But I've never seen it so clearly, you know, balanced in the direction of telling the truth about what was going on with Donald Trump and the Republicans as I saw it over the last couple of years. And it seems to me that the Democrats never really, they were still acting defensively and squandered that advantage, didn't use it to their advantage in a way that, I mean, you and I've talked about this from the beginning, and you're right. It's not just the campaigns. It wasn't just the agenda. It wasn't just the candidates or whatever. But the one thing I think we both have agreed on from the beginning that they failed to do was to tie Donald Trump around the necks of the Republican Party and light him on fire in and make sure that that those people, I mean, they were, it was clear that they were looking at trying to get all these suburban, you know, resistance moms and who, you know, disaffected Republicans and people like that to vote against Donald Trump. And those are the ticket splitters that made the difference in those states where they lost House, you know, they lost those races in the House, and they failed to gain the Senate. So, you know, this was that was a squandered opportunity, and it's not going to last. You and I both know what the media is getting ready to do, right?
You can already see it, right? You can already see it. Yeah. It's like it was embedded in that, you know, that what I was saying about the AP reporting on the stimulus.
Yeah.
And the reformation process, you already see people out there. Bill Barr, well, look at Bill Barr showing some independence.
Good old,
I mean,
Bill Barr, yeah.
Honestly, like the ship is, you know, he jumped off the ship, folks. Well, I got news for you. The ship was like, you know, three quarters underwater. You know, he was going
to
float anyways.
Largely due to him, by the way. Yeah, thanks a lot.
I mean, it, I guess we're going to have to see. I think the other side of the ledger, though, is also equally interesting. The real question is, like, you know, Donald Trump is going to be increasingly isolated. I think you and I predicted probably the day after he was elected that the day that he leaves, the Republicans would immediately start pretending like they didn't know him and, you know, can't remember what party he was from, et cetera, et cetera. But it's going to be interesting to see how much he decides to take with him, right? I mean, he's going to be out of office in a matter of weeks. And the real question is, how much does he maintain that he's going to vote? I mean, he's going to run in 2024. I don't think he will, but I think he's going to pretend that he will for as long as he can.
Oh, he'll milk it. Yeah.
I mean, how much is he going to dog the Republicans? And how will Republicans respond? I mean, that is really going to be the most interesting question, you know, at least on that side of the ledger, is like, how much will the Donald Trump maintain, you know, keep Republicans in his sphere of influence? And will Democrats ever realize, like, hey, we can exploit this. You know, they didn't do it while he was president, but I don't know. Maybe they'll do it when he's not. I'm not sure.
I'm not sure either, but the opportunity, I think, will be there, at least in the first 2 years. And that's going to be vital, right? I mean, they've got to start running already to you know, to sort of offset whatever losses they can anticipate in the 2022 midterms. You know, that's just the way they have to be thinking of it. And making Donald Trump be the de facto leader of the Republican Party during that period would be great, I think. I mean, not because we want to pay any attention to Donald Trump or we care about him in any way or that he matters, but because the Republicans clearly are already showing signs that they don't want to be, you know, and of course the 2024 presidential hopefuls don't want to be tied to him. I mean, they don't want him around, you know, sucking up the money and sucking up the attention and doing all that. So there is a huge advantage there, which I fully expect that they will not take advantage of, because they're going to say, well, we, you know, that's in the past. We don't want to give him any more oxygen. We don't want to talk about him or whatever. And on top of that, by the way, Sam, if they were to do the things that need to be done to sort of set things straight by running, by having Biden appoint some the three commissions, I think we talked about it last week, you know, a commission for the over the pandemic, which has to be done. They've got to take a look at what went wrong there and you know, make sure that they fix whatever systemic issues contributed to that, even aside from Trump. The assault on democracy. And then, you know, the, what happened with the Department of Homeland Security and what happened at the border and everything that went on with all that, that those are three things that, that happened in the Trump administration that, that have to be looked at. If the Democrats handled that well and did all that, did investigations with a, you know, in a you know, strategic way, they could make Donald Trump the ongoing Republican Party and run against him in 2022. I mean, you know, Republicans ran against Franklin Roosevelt all the way into the 80s.
Right.
You know? I mean, this is, you know, and
they were running against Hillary Clinton this time, and she hasn't been in elected office in 10 years.
Exactly.
15 years.
Exactly. Exactly, and Democrats have never mastered that skill.
You know, there was a moment
against the other side.
There was a moment in the beginning of the Obama administration. I don't know if you remember this, and there was a lot of things that the Obama administration did poorly from a political standpoint, in my opinion, and you know, including sort of defunding outside organizations and disempowering them. But if you remember, early on, they kept sort of centering Rush Limbaugh. And
yeah.
I don't know if you remember, they like made him the intellectual pillar of the Republican Party. And it was quite effective for a while. But it only took them so far. Donald Trump is obviously a much different and a much more, I think, valuable asset to Democrats, because,
agreed,
you know, you get the motivating factor of agitating against Donald Trump without the counterbalanced, like, sort of, you know, opportunity for people to vote for Donald Trump, then you're starting to look at like a 2018 scenario. It's not going to be complete, but that is exactly what, you know, Democrats were, if they were smart, they would be calling, you know, the Republican Party the party of Trump. You know,
absolutely. I will be. I mean, I don't know if the Democrats will be smart enough to do that, but I will be doing it. I'll be tying Trump to these people, and they deserve it. I mean, that's not some kind of, you know, just political strategy.
Right.
Those people were collaborators in this mess, and the mess that the Democrats are facing and the country is facing. I mean, it's not all just due to Donald Trump. The pandemic would have hit us anyway, but it would not have been nearly as bad as it is. Neither would the economic fallout. Neither would everything else. And even more importantly, the polarization existed before. But Trump and his accomplices have spent the last 4 years turning this country into an absolute, you know, hate-filled mess. And exacerbated the divisions in this country, you know, in a way that I've never seen in my, I mean, you know, I mean, I was around in the 60s, I was just a kid, but, you know, this is along those lines, only without the fun and games of, you know, the youth movement that was, you know, out there making great music and, you know, doing a lot of fun stuff. I mean, this is a grim political, you know, divided country. It's very, very grim, very pessimistic and ugly. And all of that was exacerbated by the Republicans and Donald Trump. And they are going to have to wear that, as far as I'm concerned, and forever, as far as I'm concerned. I mean, what they've done is absolutely horrific. And, you know, we have 300 and what is it today? 318,000 dead people. I mean, my God, you know, how can they possibly be, you know, just, and they're going to try. They're already doing it. They're already trying to pretend like, you know, well, you know, gee, that, what a shame. Anyway, let's move on. No, they don't get to move on. Now, as far as I'm concerned, and the Democrats shouldn't let them move on either. They should have, you know, whatever the death toll of this is, that is the Republican death toll.
Yeah.
And they should be, you know, held liable for it.
Without a doubt. Well, with all that said, Heather, can't thank you enough for your work on this program the past year. I mean, really the past several years, but we're at the end of this year. So I will confine it to that for the sake of this, this sign off. But, and you know, I am so, grateful to have you, to be heading into this year, with you. This is going to be a time of like a different, we're heading into a different political era, and it's going to be, tumultuous, but in a different way. There's going to be a lot of nuance, it seems to me, in terms of like the different currents that are going to be influencing our politics in a way that wasn't, you know, that is different. I mean, you and I have both been through this before, coming out of like the Bush years, where the sort of political winds just blew in basically two different directions. And we're heading into an era where the political winds are going to be blowing in all sorts of different directions. And, it's going to be, and I am very grateful to have the opportunity to analyze those different winds, with you, because I think you're one of the, smartest people out there and the most adept at pulling these strands apart and explaining to us what's happening. And so I just want to thank you and wish you a very, very happy, New Year's. And, for all of us, let's hope that 2021 is, a major upgrade from 2020 to, 2020.
Absolutely. I think it will be. And thanks so much, Sam. Thank you so much for having me every week. It's just, it is always so interesting to me to share ideas with you and to be able to exchange this. It's really informs my writing, and I think it informs everybody to listen to you and to get your input on all this stuff. So thanks so much for letting me be a part of it. I really enjoy it, and I super appreciate it. So, and you have a great New Year's, too. I mean, I think it's going to be, well, it's bound to be better just because Donald Trump is gone. That alone is enough. So, you know, we'll start off maybe with a little more optimistic view of the world than we did start last year.
Indeed. Heather, folks can check out Heather at salon.com, of course, and also at her Uber blog, Hullabaloo. Heather Digby, we will see you in a couple of weeks in 2021.
I'll be here.
I am here with Bronco Marchetich, which I think I got that name right. I did some research beforehand. He is a Jacobin staff writer and author of Yesterday's Man, The Case Against Joe Biden. And right now, Bronco, you are in New Zealand. Can you talk about, which you hinted to me before we started recording, the experience in New Zealand with COVID? Because obviously Jacinda Ardern has gained national praise, or international praise, I should say, for her handling of the pandemic. And it seems to be quite different than what we're experiencing here in North America.
Yeah, obviously the Jacinda Ardern government has got a lot of international acclaim and domestic acclaim for handling the virus. And I think, you know, having now been here for the past month or so, it's clear why. You know, I spent, like everyone else in North America, 8 months, you know, observing social distancing and basically locking myself away from most people, trying to avoid social contact as much as possible, and then having to come back here and then basically getting rid of all those rules and immediately, you know, being able to go back to bars and speak to people face to face without mask coverings. It's surreal. And so, you know, the well-deserved pandemic response accolades for the Ardern government. You know, there are other things about the Ardern government that they should probably move on a little more boldly.
I'm not saying it's all rainbows and smiles, but
yeah.
Yeah, no, that it's just when you said that to me, no masks, going out to bars, it sounds like a different world. Let's get into your piece, because you wrote a piece that I thought was fascinating, Fighting the Pandemic versus Saving the Economy is a False Choice. And I've always thought that this was the case, but the way you articulated it, it was just a lot more succinct than my abstract thoughts on the matter. Basically, Democrats like Joe Biden, Democrats like Andrew Cuomo, who's been the blue face of the pandemic response. It's always, we have to sacrifice these businesses. You have to tough it out. You have to be okay with not getting paid if you're in the service industry, for example, in order for public health to be paramount and for everybody to stay safe. That is a false choice in my view, and you laid that out quite well in your piece. Can you expand upon that?
Yeah, I mean, the way that the pandemic has been sold in the United States is, you know, it's one or the other. You can either wrangle the pandemic and make it manageable or, you know, not killing thousands of people a day, or you can have a strong economy that is, you know, going to make sure that people aren't falling through the cracks and homeless and jobless and that kind of thing. Those are the stark choices that were laid out for people in the election, and people basically voted on which one was more important. And as you say, that's not really the case. There's no necessary division between handling the pandemic and the economy, because they're really one and the same. You know, I put out in the piece that one of the things that was most important to the economy during those early months of the I want to say lockdown, but it wasn't really a lockdown. The sort of early restrictions that were then lifted, and then sort of, you know, this haphazard kind of piecemeal restrictions that were put on after that. One of the things that was keeping the U.S. economy alive, probably the thing more than anything else, was the extended unemployment insurance, which of course was a pandemic measure, but also an economic measure. It meant that people who lost their jobs because of COVID restrictions, because of lockdowns, would not be punished for it, would not end up, you know, being evicted or having to do risky things to maintain an income to be able to feed themselves while the economy was basically on pause. And, you know, it ended up working, not just to keep people out of those dire straits, but also to ensure that the consumer spending that is basically the foundation of the economy continued at levels almost to what they were before the pandemic. And so that's one really clear case of where the pandemic and the economic response actually dovetail. We don't have to choose between them. And it's something that actually was very popular.
Absolutely. I think it's been underreported how much of a boon to Trump's reelection effort, and part of why we saw maybe more popularity for him than initially anticipated, which was reflected down ballot, was his signature on those stimulus checks, which they've done studies. The checks, but more specifically the UI that you're discussing, kept millions out of poverty. And yet the Republicans are fixated on the small percentage. Oh, maybe some of these Americans got a little bit more in unemployment than they would have been making at their starvation wage initially. But to me, that goes to show, wow, that lifted these people out of poverty. Perhaps they could be making this living wage once we get past this horrific moment.
Yeah, and at the same time, that kind of rhetoric has been coupled with this this obscene bailout for if you're a corporation, if you're even a lobbying firm, in some cases, you know, you can get basically an unlimited flow of money from the federal government, which completely undermines this idea that government spending is an issue at all, which of course we know from the Republicans' history they don't really believe. But secondly, that, this idea that if you pay people too much, they simply just won't go back to work, they won't do their jobs. There's never been any evidence of that. It's the same thing that they said during the 2009-2010 period, that unemployment insurance was keeping people from going back to their jobs. Wasn't true then, wasn't true now. And I mean, if that was true, then what about this massive flow of government welfare to the very richest in the country? Shouldn't that be effectively shutting down economic activity because people are simply too lazy to bother going back? Of course, those rules only apply if you're poor or if you're middle class, not if you are ridiculously wealthy.
Right, exactly. And obviously, because of your book about Joe Biden, you have a lot of familiarity with his kind of thinking. And to me, what is disturbing is, one, the Republicans are already pushing this concept of austerity. The only thing that that Mitch McConnell is prioritizing is this liability shield for corporations from any lawsuits if they endanger their employees. But the thing that freaks me out most about Biden is that he shows deference to that kind of thinking as opposed to rejecting it outright, because all of the empirical data shows that, in fact, government spending and stimulus and putting hands in the money of people, especially in this moment, that's what helps the economy. You know, when you give money to rich people and you give money to corporations, they give stock buybacks to their executives, and then wealthy people, they hoard it or they don't recirculate it into the economy. So when you're thinking of it from a purely capitalistic perspective, it's the right thing to do. But that's what shocks me, I guess, still in this moment, even though he's been in politics for this long, he still thinks the Republicans advocating for austerity, and even centrist Democrats or people like Rahm Emanuel, who thankfully aren't going to be in the administration as of now, that he still thinks that's a viable perspective.
Yeah, I tried to lay out in my book on Biden, which I'd hoped that people would sort of absorb before, you know, voting in the Democratic primary, but evidently not. I tried to kind of lay out some of the dangers of having Biden in the role of the president, but really in any major role in politics, which is that because of the particular lessons that he took from his early life and career, you know, in the period that he became a politician, the 1970s to the 80s, because of that, Biden's kind of go-to move is to essentially kind of pander to the most extreme right-wing elements in the country. So, you know, the kind of things that are in reality, in the grand scheme of the U.S. population, actually pretty fringe views, but views that nonetheless tend to be pretty popular among Republicans and other right-wing elites. And Biden sort of takes that as kind of the baseline to which he needs to signal to, even as, you know, Republicans and those same other right-wing elites are wildly out of touch in a whole host of issues from where the American public is. And we've kind of seen that a little bit with even the coronavirus response from Biden, not just on the kind of economic stuff, but also just in terms of the purely kind of technocratic elements of dealing with the virus, or the practical elements of dealing with the virus. You know, Biden has now said you only need to wear a mask for 100 days, which I'm aware of no scientist or expert who you know, says that, you know, don't worry, you only need to do this for 100 days. People are saying, depending on how long the vaccine takes to roll out, and even once the vaccine rolls out, you know, masks should maybe become a semi-permanent aspect of our culture. You know, if there's more pandemics on the way, or, you know, if there's a flu going around, it's part of the reason why Japan had such a good response, even though the government response wasn't very good, the culture of mask wearing. So that's one thing. You know, the other thing is he's also saying you don't have to do a national lockdown, I guess because he doesn't want to play into Republican attacks. On that very basis that we were talking about, that, you know, a lockdown will destroy the economy, which of course it would, absent any sort of government spending to make sure that people are protected. But of course, the other lesson that Biden learned and has really internalized for his entire career is that government spending is a chief issue that is obsessing the nation, and that one cannot spend too much money. Debt is too bad, and one should avoid having the government do too much, particularly to help people economically if possible.
Certainly, yeah. That's what keeps people up at night. That's why those stimulus checks were so popular. You did touch on some of these technocratic elements of what Biden is pushing in your piece, and how his 7-point plan is really just about contact tracing and mask wearing and vaccine distribution and task forces and all of these things that, like, it reminds me of what Pelosi said the other day, where she had to come up with an excuse for why she turned down the $1.8 trillion stimulus that Mnuchin agreed to that had pretty much everything she wanted except for the testing and contact tracing strategy, which at the time I said was BS because this was the kind of deal that even leftists, even if a leftist was the Speaker of the House, they would accept. But she didn't want to give Trump any advantage before the election, so she turned it down, and now she's justifying why less than half a loaf, no stimulus checks, for example, half the UI that you discussed earlier, why that's acceptable. And she said it's because a vaccine is coming and it's an answer to our prayers, and now Biden is in charge, which just means there's a blue seat in the Oval Office, now the red seat. That changes nothing about the economic harm that people are facing. So that's what bothers me about this. I'm not really asking a question. It's more of a discussion. But it really does mirror Biden's more, we're going to take the science approach, but what about the, you know, piles and piles of economic harm and horrors that people are facing?
Yeah, I mean, I'd actually written a piece about this just before this latest one. And, you know, what's even more alarming is that, yeah, Biden's not really listening to the science and the data, which tells us that a kind of piecemeal or kind of nuanced restrictions, as they're talking about it, at this stage of the virus, where it's just running as rampant as it is in the United States, and the United States is by far has the worst situation out of any country in the world regarding this, that you can't just sort of do these piecemeal restrictions. You really have to do a very concerted, relatively strict stay-at-home order, which no one likes, and you know, for good reason, but as a way to arrest the virus's spread and to sort of be able to implement all these technocratic things that are important, to be clear, you know, vaccine distribution, PPE production, contact tracing and testing, all that is important. You know, you need that national lockdown to sort of, one, implement it, and then also you need the economic response to sort of get people on board with it. You know, one thing I would add is that despite the fact that Biden feels the need to kind of gesture towards this anti-lockdown feeling, there was a recent survey done by, I think, four different universities, Harvard and some others. They interviewed 20,000 people in all 50 states, and they actually found that large majorities of people, you know, across racial, gender, even partisan lines, age, even. The partisan lines were less emphatic, but nonetheless, still, large majorities of people did support pretty strict stay-at-home conditions for a month. You know, if the right support was given to people, you know, they were willing to stay at home and avoid large gatherings. They were willing to even close down businesses, at least some businesses. They were willing to wear masks, all this kind of thing. So these measures are popular. It's just, I think people have been sort of sold this idea that it's just, one, it's impossible. And you know, two, it's just so, people are so against it that it would never, you can't even make a case for it, basically, which isn't quite the case. Just on the issue of the $1,200 checks, I'll just add to that as well. The Wall Street Journal talked to people in some of those border towns in Texas, the Latino heavy towns that ended up going for Trump in this election, or swinging more towards Trump than they had been for Clinton in 2016, just a stunning result. And one of the things they found is that people really appreciated those $1,200 checks. And you know, Trump signing his name, as obnoxious as it was at the time, people actually thought, oh, wow, this guy really cares about me.
I did. I mean, yeah. Look, like, not too, but I mean, he's a marketer. And anyway, go on. I'm so sorry.
No. You're completely right. And the other thing I would add is that, you know, it's hard for us to imagine, because so much of Trump's response was at best inadequate and, you know, just at worst criminally negligent. But some of the measures he took, and I'm thinking particularly of the eviction ban, as many loopholes as there were in that and continue to allow people to be evicted and kicked out of their homes, as true as that all is, it was still a pretty bold measure, along with some of the other stuff he did, the student loan forgiveness for veterans and, you know, stopping student loan repayments, all that kind of thing, moving money from FEMA to for unemployment insurance. again, very inadequate in the scheme of actually what we're talking about and the scope of the U.S. response and the U.S. pandemic situation. However, when you compare it to Biden, you know, in an election, you don't have to necessarily be the best leader of all time. You just have to be one step ahead of the other guy. And that's kind of what Trump ended up doing. And, you know, with the eviction ban, Biden in August, I believe, put out a emergency housing package call. You know, he said, well, unemployment insurance is ending. We need to have an emergency housing package. The president needs to act right now. And what was in it? It was, subsidies for health insurance.
Subsidies, grants, insurance, yada, yada.
And no mention of an eviction ban. And then what happened was a month later, Trump signed that executive order that basically put an eviction moratorium in place. Again, tons of flaws with that order. But the fact is that it was still something that Biden was not even willing to come out and say. And I think that's why you keep getting this bifurcated political discussion in the U.S. where it's either the pandemic or it's the economy. You can't do both.
Well, I mean, yeah, I still have this theory about Trump is he would have been a much better president if he just operated in a vacuum of self-interest, because he does have this crowd surfer mentality where he has no empathy or understanding and is, you know, genuinely horrific person, but he does know how to crowd surf and gets what people care about and isn't constrained by this old school ideology that Biden is ascribing to of like, well, we have to balance the budget. We can't be seen as spending too much money. We'll do these very minute tweaks around the edges where you can apply for a Pell Grant or you can, you know, things that actually bother. Like, even if it's a good thing on the whole, even if it's a marginal help, the fact that it's so bureaucratic is a huge turnoff to people. So finally, I just wanted to ask about this because to wrap up what you're talking about this false dichotomy between fighting the virus and the economy, there were other countries that did this way more effectively than the United States, and even countries with leadership, like in Germany, you know, Angela Merkel is not some progressive socialist, right? But at the beginning of the pandemic, I believe they did wage replacement, might have been up to 70% for some certain bracket. But in order to lock down, the government subsidized people's wages to a certain amount so they could stay at home. And we've seen this internationally. And yet the United States has refused to embrace any of this kind of talk. So I'm wondering what your perspective is on that and if that ties into your piece at all.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because the United States in many ways really does have a ruling class that is uniquely cruel towards its own people. I mean, there are many that are horrifically cruel, but the United States, the people that run the country are particularly, I think, callous towards the needs of not even the poor, but even you know, people who are sort of just getting by. We have, at this point, you know, the IMF, which is hardly a bastion of leftism or radicalism, is basically saying the things that the left has been saying throughout this crisis and before, which is that you need to engage in short-term big spending, set up safety nets, tax the wealthy, then redirect that into health and social programs so that people, whether in this pandemic or later, are taken care of. The IMF chief economist wrote a piece in the Financial Times that said that the fiscally responsible thing right now is to do a sort of fiscal stimulus to increase spending. The Financial Times, also not a bastion of left-wing radicalism, published an op-ed, an editorial board editorial, earlier this year, where they basically said, you know, we need to do a sharp break from what came before, the kind of policies that have dominated the neoliberal era of the past 40 years, and we need to start taxing the rich and creating actual, you know, something approaching decent societies that take care of people. So the traditional kind of neoliberal, you know, intelligentsia, ruling class, whatever, they recognize that if you don't do this stuff, There could be a real instability in the system, which, of course, they don't want. They want to keep things relatively afloat. But the funny thing is that in the United States, that the Democrats, the Republicans, the galaxies of kind of consultants and thinkers that surround those two parties, they don't seem to have really swallowed this view. And it kind of reminds me of, you know, with Roosevelt. Roosevelt was not a radical in the 1930s. What he did was he wanted to save capitalism. And so that's where the New Deal came from. It was a way to sort of accommodate to the system, to take away people's grievances with the system, and to make life bearable enough that people sort of said, well, we don't want to go into a full-scale revolution, you know, and bring this down. And in the United States right now, no one, the people running the country don't seem to even want to do that. They're so attached to this kind of strict neoliberal dogma that they are kind of contributing to this this boiling pot, you know, that erupted already once earlier this year after the shooting of George Floyd. And you know, it's only a matter of time before it erupts again, you know, whether it's because of a police shooting or something else.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. Bronco Marchetich of Jacobin, you have a bunch of great articles up there, and people can read your book, Yesterday's Man, The Case Against Joe Biden. Thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me today.
Thanks for having me.
Well, that's it for Ring of Fire in 2020. It's been a difficult year for so many of you folks, and frankly, for all of us around here, it's been a little bit tricky too. Our wish for 2021 would be to bring health and happiness into all of your homes. Thanks for allowing us to be a small part of your lives this year. We will continue to bring you more Ring of Fire in the new year, better than ever. For Emma Vigeland, Heather Parton, I'm Sam Cedar. This has been Ring of Fire Radio.